Hello and welcome to the first episode of The Lawdown, where we bring you the lowdown on the law of the week. I'm Sarah Chilton.
And I'm Wani Sander, and we're both lawyers at CM Murray in London. We both specialise in discrimination, employment and partnership law.
In this first podcast, we're going to talk about four stories which have caught our eye in the press recently.
So firstly, there's Alex Salmon. You couldn't have missed that. He's had allegations of a sexual nature against him, and he's had quite an interesting response, which we'd like to discuss in a bit more detail. Secondly, there's a story about discrimination of a one-legged golfer who was refused access to a golf course. And thirdly, there's been some reports that PwC have been allowing their workers to work whenever they want. That sounds really nice, doesn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, I'd try that out.
And Wani, what's last on the agenda?
We couldn't let our first podcast go by without mentioning Trump. You would have read that he has made his nomination to the Supreme Court, and it's Brett Kavanaugh. So we want to discuss the differences between nominations to the Supreme Court in the US and in the UK. So to get us going, Sarah's going to talk about Alex Salmon.
Thank you, Wani. I like to keep an avid interest as to what's going on in the Scottish legal system north of the border, having practiced there for several years before I moved to London, and I've been particularly interested in this story about Alex Salmon. It is reported that the former Scottish First Minister has been accused of sexual harassment that pertained to his time in office as First Minister, and that those allegations have been investigated. And this has all come to light because Alex Salmon himself has launched a judicial review in the Scottish courts to seek review of the process used by the government to investigate these allegations against him. A judicial review is a type of court application where somebody seeks a review of a decision of a public body, in this case the Scottish government. And what Alex Salmon is alleging is that the process that has been used by the government in investigating these allegations is unfair and unjust, and he's saying that he hasn't had access to all the evidence against him. Now, this type of process is one with which we are quite familiar in the employment context, and we advise a lot on the conducting of investigations in the workplace, including in relation to sexual harassment. Now, in a normal workplace investigation, you would expect that the person who's been accused of the misconduct would in fact have an opportunity to respond to all the evidence against them in relation to the allegations. And without access to all the evidence against them in relation to the allegations, there is a risk that that process would not be fair. And that could limit the ability for the employer to take certain steps, such as dismissal or other disciplinary sanctions against that employee. But there are circumstances in which it is difficult sometimes to make sure that the accused person has got all the information against them. There may be confidentiality considerations where, for example, in a sexual harassment investigation, the person who has made the allegations doesn't feel comfortable with the accused person knowing their identity. And it may be, in some circumstances, appropriate for their identity not to be revealed. And that's a situation in which the accused person might complain that they don't have all the evidence against them. There may also be considerations if there's police involvement in a sexual harassment investigation. If, for example, the harassment amounts to assault, there may be situations in which the police do not want the employer to trample over the crime scene. And I don't mean physically trample over the crime scene. I mean, they don't want the employer to meddle with witnesses so that potential witness accounts get contaminated or the accounts of the accused perpetrator get contaminated. So without knowing more about this situation, it is hard to know whether or not there has been fair process or not. And hopefully what we will discover as the court process that Alex Salmon has instigated progresses is more about the circumstances, and hopefully we may get some interesting judgment from the court as to what constitutes fair and due process in an investigation such as this. The other aspect of this that I found interesting was the crowdfunding aspect. Alex Salmon has reportedly raised £100,000 crowdfunding his legal action, and it's Something that we've seen developing in the legal sector recently, and I think there have been a couple of cases in the NHS recently where people have used crowdfunding to access justice.
Yeah, there have been at least two cases which have involved crowdfunding and NHS doctors who've had cases that they tried to bring. So one was Chris Day, which was a whistleblowing detriment case that went up to the Court of Appeal and which we were lucky enough to be involved with, acting for the Intervenor Public Concern at Work, which is a whistleblowing charity. And there was also the more recent one, the case of Dr. Bauer Garber, who also used crowdfunding in order to access justice and fight against some allegations of negligence in her capacity as a doctor. So this is something we've been seeing and probably will be seeing a lot more as people tend to respond, actually, I think, when they see things online that they can contribute to.
Yeah, and it's, I think, going to be a growing way of people funding legal action, which is great, because actually what we also see is so many situations where people can't access the courts.
Because it's too expensive. Yeah.
Interesting to see where Alex Salmond goes with his application. We will be watching that closely.
Indeed.
And another story that's caught my attention is the story about Trump's nomination for the Supreme Court in the US. And just yesterday I was watching the news and I saw that the Senate committee hearing had started. Yeah. And there was a bit of civil unrest in the hearing as protesters got in and started to cause trouble. And then outside the hearing, there appeared to be people protesting dressed as handmaids, which will mean something to those of you who have been watching The Handmaid's Tale. And if it doesn't mean anything to you, then I would recommend it for a watch. But Wanu, coming back to the law, what is going on in the US? Why is there a hearing and why does Trump have so much power to appoint people to the Supreme Court?
So unlike the UK, the US has a system where their president, in this case Donald Trump, gets to nominate who he wants to replace whoever's left the Supreme Court. And that's the reason why he's got the opportunity to do so now. So somebody's left, who I understand is actually on the Democrat side. And he has now nominated somebody else, Brett Kavanaugh, who is extremely right-wing, as I understand it.
And so they don't have to have a certain number of Democrats, a certain number of Republicans. It doesn't have to be balanced.
Not at all. Actually, there is no criteria whatsoever. In fact, the person doesn't even have to be legally qualified. Wow. They don't have to be a judge. They could be a politician or from any other walk of life. They just have to be nominated by the president. And the next stage is after that nomination, they then go before the Senate Judiciary Committee, who asked them lots of questions and statements. And I think that's what you were talking about and where people were protesting outside those hearings.
And so is that open to the public? Is that how those protesters managed to get into the committee?
I think they are. And I guess that's a positive thing because they get to see, you know, someone being grilled who's about to go to the highest court in the land in the US. So
is there any kind of democratic system involved in the appointment to the Supreme Court?
A little bit, let's say. Essentially, after that nomination has gone to the Senate Judicial Committee, they will vote on whether or not that nomination goes to the full Senate. And once it gets to the full Senate, it just needs to pass a simple majority vote. And then that person is sitting on the Supreme Court.
Wow. So it's quite different from the UK then?
Very different from the UK. In the UK, to be appointed to the Supreme Court, you have to have held high judicial office for at least 2 years. But there's an alternative route as well.
What's high judicial office? Is that court in, a judge in
another court?
Yeah,
so like that's the High Court judges in England, Wales, Northern Ireland, Court of Appeal judges as well. And in Scotland, judges of the Court of Session.
Yeah.
but there are other routes as well. If you haven't been a judge, you could also have been practicing as a qualifying practitioner for at least 15 years, and you need to show that you've been gaining experience of law in that time period. There's criteria, and then there are several people who also have to be consulted. It's no longer solely on the Lord Chancellor anymore. There are quite a wider group of people that are consulted. And more recently, what has been adopted is actually an open application kind of competition for these roles, which are actually advertised. Okay. So I think there's an attempt to make it a lot more open and transparent than it once was.
Okay. So really, anyone who meets that criteria can apply. They might not be selected ultimately, but
indeed,
it's kind of open to all.
Your
relevant qualifications. Good. So that's quite different to the system they have over on the other side of the Atlantic.
Yes, and definitely, we don't look at, who's on what side. If they're, in this country, it'd be, on the conservative side or way on the left. It's just more about, do they have the experience for the highest court in the land?
Yeah. Which is comforting, I think, from the perspective of a lawyer.
For us,
we take cases to the courts, we hope that our judges that are looking at those cases and making really critical decisions for our clients' interests know what the law is.
And they're going to be impartial and neutral.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Objective.
Yeah, and they're not going to take these extraneous views, their extraneous political views, into what really does affect somebody's livelihood and life in a lot of cases.
Or their personal views either. Yeah.
Bonu, what other stories have you been looking at this week?
So, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, there was a story recently about a one-legged golfer who's suing Brentwood Council because he wasn't allowed to go onto the course with his buggy, which he needs to be able to play the game. From what has been reported, it seems that he's been able to go to hundreds of golf courses across the world with his buggy. And for some reason, Brentwood Council would not let him without a medical certificate and without having given them 7 days prior notice.
And is he suing the council for this?
He is.
And what's his claim?
So, the stories don't give that much detail, but from a discrimination perspective, there are probably two different angles he could take. Firstly, indirect discrimination. And Sarah, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Yes. So indirect discrimination is a concept that we frequently come across in the employment context. So I'll use the employment context as an example, but the law equally applies to service providers, as is in this particular case. And it arises where, for example, an employer applies a policy, and that policy is called a provision criterion of practice in the law of indirect discrimination. And they apply this provision criterion or practice across the board. So they either apply it to a group of people or the whole workforce. And that provision criterion or practice, albeit applied equally across the board, disproportionately disadvantages people who share a protected characteristic. And a protected characteristic is one of the 9 characteristics set out in the Equality Act that are protected by discrimination legislation in the UK, one of which is disability. Other examples are age, race, sex, etc. And so what that then means is that if, for example, this golfer was to argue that the requirement not to have a buggy on the course was a provision criterion or practice, which it would appear could be argued because it seems, and obviously, as one who says, we don't have much detail about what's been reported, but it appears that no one is allowed a buggy on the course.
Yeah.
Disabled people might be allowed a buggy on the course if they can prove it, but the policy is that no one's allowed one, initially. That would potentially be a provision criterion or practice, but that provision criterion or practice disadvantages disabled people because they are more likely to need a buggy.
Indeed.
So there is a potential indirect discrimination there, and I think it's been reported that that's the type of claim that's being pursued.
Yes.
But Wanu, is there anything else that might arise in a situation like this or a similar situation?
Yeah, I mean, the second route or approach that could be taken is potentially to make a claim for reasonable adjustments, which particularly applies in the case of people who have the protected characteristic of disability. And what that is, basically, and it applies across the board, as you say, both to employers, service providers as well, is that the employer or service provider would have to make an adjustment if the disabled person is put at a substantial disadvantage because of what you earlier called a provision, criterion, or practice. And usually the reasonable adjustments that are made could be something like giving the disabled person in the workplace longer to complete a task, for example, or giving them some sort of physical aid, which is another type of reasonable adjustment that could be made. And in this case, potentially the reasonable adjustment is just allowing somebody with a buggy to go onto the course. Particularly in this case, from the story, it appears that he did have some proof that he needed the buggy, aside from the fact that visually it would have been very obvious to anyone that he was missing a leg.
Yeah, because I think I looked at this very quickly and it appeared he had some card with him or something, which
a medical insurance card, okay, I believe,
which indicated that he was disabled or had a disability that required the use of a buggy. So it's quite a surprising story, I think, because I think it's probably quite unusual that a service provider would be perhaps so naive as to enforce such a draconian measure against somebody who, as you say, appeared to be able to prove the disability but also visually had one leg. So hopefully he will get redress. And one thing I just wanted to note for those of you interested in disability discrimination is the question of knowledge. So it comes up a lot in the employment cases that we deal with, where we have an employer or an employee, and the employee might have a disability, but there's always a question as to whether or not the employer knows about it. And if the employer doesn't know about it or could not reasonably be expected to know about it, then there's a limit as to the claims that can be brought against the employer. An indirect discrimination claim doesn't require knowledge because, as we said, it's to do with a policy that applies to everyone, that disproportionately affects disabled people, for example, but it could equally disproportionately affect women or men or older people or younger people. But, for example, the reasonable adjustments law that you were talking about does require the employer to have knowledge, yes, of the disability, as would direct disability discrimination. And there's another category of disability discrimination as well, which protects people from being discriminated against because of something which arises in consequences of a disability, and that also requires knowledge. And when I say knowledge, I mean actual knowledge or constructive knowledge, because of course it doesn't necessarily mean that the employee, for example, has to tell the employer that they have a disability. There are perhaps circumstances from which the employer should reasonably deduce that fact. And there is also quite a lot of more complicated provisions around the extent to which an employer should seek medical reports, and, you know, expert evidence on various different things, particularly related to disability. So it's an interesting topic that comes up a lot in the work that we do. And obviously, if you want to find out any more about it, then just get in touch with us and we'll be happy to talk further with you. One other thing that's come out of the press in the last week or so is a story that PwC, one of the big four accountancy firms, are allowing staff to work the hours they want to work. Now, we don't know exactly what the policy says, but on the face of it, and the headlines would suggest, that people can basically decide when they want to work and when they don't want to work. I read a little bit about it, and I think what they are aiming to do is attract skilled people who don't want to work 9 to 5. And they're often things like people working shorter weeks, or people working only a few weeks a year, or maybe a few days a month. And so it's quite interesting. Yeah. And I wonder whether it will attract more skilled people. But I don't know what you think about it.
Well, it could be interesting. I guess it's how they implement it. So is it going to be a case of people having to have specific days that they work in a particular month that can't be changed? Because one of the things is going to be organisational difficulty. How is the business actually going to plan for who comes in when? Is this going to be something that takes a lot more administrative resources? That's one thing to consider. But on the other hand, it could be a huge motivating factor for people who do want to have flexible working lifestyles, who would be prepared to commit to the business, but who just don't want to work the standard 9 to 5. Who knows? We could all be doing that in the future, Sarah.
Well, I think that's one thing. I think once someone big like PwC do this, then it will make it harder for their competitors to not do it if they think they're going to lose talent by not offering certain flexibility. And then if something becomes standard somewhere like all the big four, then it filters through to other professional services. And you get to the point where, you know, if it works for them,
everyone will basically be thinking, well, why can't I just work the hours I want to work? And there's a certain attractiveness in that.
There is. I mean, there is the other potential issue of if there aren't fixed hours, there can become cultures ingrained in a firm anyway, just led by the staff, where one person works really long hours and everyone else feels compelled to do the same. So it could have an opposite effect. Who knows?
I think they've done studies on companies where they have unlimited holidays, and they actually find that because they're unlimited, people don't feel that they can take as many as they might take if they have an actual allowance. And I think they did some study in one organisation that had unlimited holidays, and people still took, I don't know, no more than 25, say, because 25 was the standard in that industry, because they felt that because it was unlimited, they were pushing it too far by taking 26. So it may have the same effect. As you say, people might actually work harder because they are worried about being seen to not work hard enough.
Indeed.
Yeah, so we have to see how that works out for PwC, and I'm sure we'll be seeing it rolling out across other organisations in the future.
So thank you, Sarah. And that draws us to the end of our first episode of The Lawdown. We hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you want any further information, do go onto our website. We've got lots of legal knowledge on there, lots of articles and other podcasts. And also, if you'd like us to discuss any other news stories, like anything to do with discrimination, employment law, partnership law, or anything to do with practice and procedure in the courts, then please do contact us. You can get our details on our website, www.cm-murray.com, or in the podcast notes.
Thank you very much for listening, and we will speak to you in a couple of weeks' time.
Bye.